It's time for Fed Talk, the live show for feds in the know. From federal agencies to Capitol Hill, the attorneys of Shaw, Bransford, and Roth bring in experts from across the federal community to bring you inside the issues. Fed Talk is meant to provide general information about legal issues. However, the views expressed in this program are not intended to provide legal counseling. Listeners are cautioned not to rely upon any statements made in resolving legal issues they may face, but instead to consult with their own attorney about specific situations. Attorneys are not engaged in providing legal services while appearing on the program and are not responsible in any manner for the consequences that may stem directly or indirectly from reliance on any statement made during this program.
Good morning and welcome to Fed Talk. I'm Deborah Roth. I'm hosting today's show. For our listeners who tune in regularly, you are aware that about once a quarter, we try to bring you the Federal Law Enforcement Show. Regular guests on our show for the Federal Law Enforcement Show are John Adler, our very good friend who's the president of FLIOA. We bring in WIFL, Women in Federal Law Enforcement. We've had Margie Moore and Kathy Sands. Well, today's Federal Law Enforcement Show, we really are bringing you insiders. Today we have with us Stacia Hilton. Everybody knows who she is, but I'm going to tell you anyway. She's the director of the U.S. Marshals Service. Good morning, Director Hilton. Welcome to our show.
Good morning, Deborah.
And we also have joining Director Hilton, we have Michelle Lenhart, who is the administrator, the agency head of the U.S. Drug Enforcement Agency. And Michelle, it's Administrator Lenhart. I know Michelle personally, and so I have slipped and called her Michelle, but we will refer to her as Administrator Lenhart. Good morning and welcome to our show.
Good morning, Deborah.
And thank you for joining us. And of course, to our regular listeners, you know Kathy Sands of WIFL. She is the president. She's had many positions at WIFL. She's also had a very long career in federal law enforcement. Kathy, welcome back to our show.
Thank you, Deborah.
And of course, I have to thank Kathy personally, because without WIFL's assistance, Women in Federal Law Enforcement, we would never have been able to bring our two guests today to the show. We worked very hard. You might not know this, but it took like 6 months or so to coordinate schedules to get these two guests with us. And it all started back in March when WIFL hosted their Women in Histories Month panel, where we got the idea. And Kathy, I really do want to thank you for helping us make this happen.
No problem.
So before we get into some of the really interesting topics we will be talking about today, I thought we'd go around the table and start with Director Hilton. Tell us a little bit. People can read your bio online, but there's nothing like having the real live body. Everybody knows you were career at Marshals Service, made it to the agency head. Tell us a little bit about your background.
We know, like many of us in law enforcement, I've always wanted to be in law enforcement ever since I was a little girl. You know, grew up in a family that wasn't law enforcement or military, so I was the baby of a large family. So it was a little bit odd, you know, when I told my parents I wanted to be a cop.
Right.
I was probably seven at the time. And they, you know, took it as it was and thought maybe, you know, eventually I'd be a nurse or something, perhaps that was a little bit more regular in the 70s.
Right, and they gave you some dolls. They gave you Barbie.
They tried their hardest. I kept my football, my basketball, my baseball bat. But, you know, I never really wavered in that. And I always say that. I just kind of stayed true to that. And by 12 or 13, I knew what university I wanted to go to, Northeastern University in Boston. I applied to one school and one job and went in on the co-op program from Northeastern. I had an opportunity to interview for the Marshals Service, and I had wanted to be a marshal. So it was the first time they were actually having a co-op with the Marshals Service. So I really started at 19 in this job. I think I was paid my first year on the job. I think it was $3,500 a year.
And you have your memory intact. Isn't that amazing?
It still is. But I fell in love with the agency early on and the mission and the people, the incredible people in the agency. And so it was like having thousands of big brothers and sisters. We were small. The women in law enforcement were very small at the time. And myself really was probably in several before me were kind of the first generation females marshals. Otherwise, they had used some of the administrative employees as matrons. So really wasn't until later 70s and stuff that we really had kind of a full workforce. So it was great. We really got along wonderful. And, you know, I had a journey of many years in the Marshal Service in many positions, both at the field level and at headquarters, kind of across our programs, judicial security, witness security. I taught at the Federal Law Enforcement Training Academy for several years. And so it was wonderful. And later I went into management. I was a chief deputy in South Carolina and later an assistant director. And so it was great. You know, I often say I kind of married into the history of the Marshal Service. My husband of 25 years was, of course, a marshal. My father-in-law was a marshal, so really since 1948, we've been in the agency.
It is family for you.
It is very family. I mean, we're just inbred. You know, my best friends come from the agency, you know, long since retired. And then I retired, you know, after a long career myself. I laugh because through
but
that.
She's too young. I mean, if you ever, if you get to see her, you'll all know what I'm talking about. Okay. She looks too young to have retired.
A soft lighting.
Right,
thank you.
Right.
So yeah, so we know it's kind of family time at our house. At my in-laws was always amazing. So I didn't have it in my own family. I had it very much there. And since my father-in-law's time, who served at many civil rights functions down at James Meredith and Ruby Bridges, and to my husband being on the busing desegregation, some of the things that the marshals are known for, hunting down fugitives. You know, we've all sometimes share over 65 years between us all. Macheteros, Vieques, Ground Zero. I was incident commander at Ground Zero. We really had our hands on a lot of major national issues and arrests. And it was really nice at one Christmas to kind of sit and talk through that. You know, yeah. So I enjoyed that. So I retired. I joined them in retirement, opened a small business. And 16 days later from
16 days you
from
lasted.
My retirement.
Right, 16.
I counted it. And when they called, I went and counted. You know, I was like, I got a call from the White House asking me if I would consider an appointment by the President of the United States to be the Director of the Marshal Service. So I often say that's a moment that you're not expecting, wasn't looking, and it was such an honor to be asked.
Yeah. And you don't say no.
Of course not.
Yeah. That's...
You take a moment only because you're trying to, you know, collect yourself.
Right.
And well, saying, really, is this...
How did this happen to me?
I always joke. I said, is this one of the guys I've been working with? Really, who is this? You know, kind of moment. So anyway, it's a privilege and an honor. And I think, you know, especially to have been career... I'm not political to be asked to come back and serve. So anyway, that's how I ended up.
That's an incredible story. And I failed to mention, which I found very interesting, that both you and Administrator Lenhart both were appointed in 2010. You sort of both nominated and appointed in 2010. You both sort of started that journey at the same time.
And I think the nomination, but
Michelle confirmed on the same day.
We confirmed on the same time, but Michelle was in leadership, you know, quite a bit longer.
Yeah,
you know, both as the deputy.
And Michelle, I know your story, but our listeners need to know it. And I'm going to call you Michelle, aren't I? I have a feeling that's where we're headed. Administrator Lenhart, I know your story. It's a great story, and I know our listeners would really like to hear your story from. Because it goes back, sorry about that, it goes way back to where you are today. And I've been watching your career personally, you know that, for 19 years I've been watching it. So I've always applauded every move you've made. But tell our listeners about yours.
Well, thanks for the opportunity. And a lot like Director Hilton, I just knew at a very young age I wanted to be in law enforcement. You know, I grew up reading Nancy Drew mysteries, and I just wanted to investigate. Always knew I wanted to be a cop, so through high school and then into college, that was my pursuit. Upon graduating from college, and there's no law enforcement in my family, I'm the oldest of seven children, and I always felt
you're the oldest, and Director Hilton's the
youngest. She's
the youngest.
That's about the only thing
that we're not the same on. And you were confirmed on the same day?
So I always felt like I was the cop in our family. I mediated all the disputes. The youngest one is just 8 years younger than me. So we were in every grade. We were a very tight-knit family. I was the law enforcement person in the family. So pursuing law enforcement, I thought the best thing I could do is get some very fast and quick law enforcement street experience. My goal was to be a police officer in a big crime infested city. I ended up growing up in Minnesota. I didn't pursue law enforcement there. I ended up as a police officer on the streets of Baltimore, and what an experience. And in doing that with absolutely no idea what the DEA was, I came across DEA agents and DEA task force officers because I patrolled an area that was crime infested, drug infested, and I learned every crime somehow came back to drug use and drug abuse.
So drug sale.
Absolutely. The violence related to it, the you know, family problems, all related to substance abuse. So that's when I took the leap and went to check out the DEA and became a DEA agent. I've been a DEA agent for 33 years.
Again, next it's
month,
just remarkable.
It'll be 33.
That is remarkable.
And it's remarkable to me that I've moved up in the agency. I've held every position you could imagine within the agency. Became the deputy administrator 10 years ago.
I remember that.
And then when
you remember that, I remember that too.
I remember. And when the administrator moved on from DEA, I was there and I was nominated by President Bush to be the next administrator. Didn't quite make it through his term and then was renominated by President Obama. And finally, in December of 2010, was confirmed by the Senate unanimously to lead this great agency.
Yeah. So the both of you are about 3 years into your term.
Yes.
About mm-hmm. 3 years. Mm-hmm. And 3 years, you know, I'm sure you feel like you got your footing, and we're going to certainly talk about some of the things that U.S. Marshals Service and DEA are doing together. And Kathy, I said to you before we went on the show that I loved all the synergy. I found it fascinating, all the synergy between the four of us. Mine was the least, but you were at Northeastern around the same time as Director Hilton.
And, a little before.
And you were a DEA agent, which is something like I know you. And how did I not know you were a DEA agent? I always think of you as customs.
Yeah. Like Michelle and Stacia, I was the first in my family to want to become a cop. I went to Northeastern. It was the only school I applied to. I wanted to be a Boston cop, ride a horse in the commons. Never quite made it. Now they don't even have horses anymore. And I ended up as a co-op student with the Federal Protective Service. And upon graduation, they hired me. And shortly after that, I ended up as a PT instructor at FLTC. And while in FLTC, DEA recruited me to join their ranks, and was in the Atlanta office, got married, husband was in Miami. Push came to shove after a couple of years. I moved over to customs and went to the Miami office and worked in the drug task force. Some people didn't even know I'd left DEA because I was doing the same job again. Over time, I just, you know, moved up. Became a supervisor. I guess back then I was one of the first female supervisors in the agency, and eventually found my way to headquarters. Every job was, you know, somebody would say, "Hey, you should go do that job." And I'd go, okay, and the promotions came with it, and in the end, it was, you know, the SES, and suddenly I found myself running a $1 billion budget, mm-hmm. and the stress that goes with it, and 31 years went by, and retired, went to the private sector for a little while, and then Margie Moore called me and said, "I'd like to retire. Would you take over WIFL?" And so she was my first year as president. Last year I was vice president, so I'm now learning how to work in the nonprofit world.
Mm-hmm. And running a great organization.
Oh, thank you.
Women in Federal Law Enforcement. As I said, you know, it's a great organization. It helped me get my show here today. And before we take our commercial break, I must say that the most fascinating thing to me about the three of your stories is your attraction to not just being a police officer in law enforcement, but truly dangerous work. Marshal Service is when you think about federal law enforcement agents who go out every day and do their job, that's really, there's real danger there in what they do. And the same at DEA. And I say that to people who work with me in our law firm and to the clients. There's a few places in the federal government that are really dangerous to work. You know, places where they're kicking in doors and really bad people are out there. And it's interesting to me that in the 70s, three women who had no police connection would be attracted to dangerous work. That's fantastic. We have to take our first commercial break. You're listening to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Today, my journey to help save people money on car insurance brought me to our nation's capital. I was taking a stroll around the mall when I met a very nice gentleman from Ohio who asked me a question. What kind of word is GEICO anyway? An excellent question, I replied. I told him that GEICO isn't a word, it's an acronym. and it stands for Government Employees Insurance Company. I explain how GEICO actually got its start 75 years ago to help federal employees save money on car insurance. Interesting, the man replied. But today, GEICO saves lots of people money on car insurance, including me. Have you ever thought about changing the name? I said. It's a thought. But Gecko sounds like GEICO. If we change the name, I might be out of a job. We strolled a bit more, stopped for some tea, and we both agreed. It's probably best to keep the name just like it is. GEICO.
To get a free rate quote, go to GEICO.com, then buy online or over the phone. If you're a federal employee or belong to an association like Big, Few, Young Government Leaders, and others, you may qualify for a special discount. Contact GEICO today to request your special federal savings.
Welcome back to Fed Talk. I'm Deborah Roth. I'm hosting today's show on federal law enforcement. It's our quarterly federal law enforcement show. Joining me in the studio live is the director of the U.S. Marshals Service, Stacia Hilton. We have the administrator from the U.S. Drug Enforcement Agency, Michelle Lenhart, and we have Women in Federal Law Enforcement's president, Kathy Sands. If you missed the first section of our show, all of our guests told us a little bit about their how they got interested in law enforcement and their careers in law enforcement. But now we're going to get into the meat and potatoes of the show, because that's why people are listening. They really want to know what's going on in each of these agencies, and they're hoping to get some real insider information. We're going to start with you, Director Hilton. Tell us a little bit about your agency, its mission, and some of the, in your mind, some of the most important work it's doing today.
Yeah, thanks, Deborah. I think one of the things I find kind of, I don't know if I want to say cute or funny when I meet people and have throughout my career when we were younger, they'll say, wow, you're a U.S. Marshal. And I'll say, yeah. And they'll say, wow. And
then Tommy Lee Jones.
Well, before Tommy Lee, they'll think of John Wayne and they'll say, what does a marshal do nowadays? You know, it was interesting. It was always kind of an interesting question. So we'd be surprised. We do exactly what we did 200, almost 25 years ago. Next year will be our anniversary. You know, we're still about tracking and hunting the worst of the worst. And, you know, we're world renowned for our tracking capabilities. And I'm so proud of the men and the women, especially the men that really stood up those capabilities in today's environment to utilize and leverage technology. But we pride ourselves in being able to kind of track that individual and really chase down the fugitives and those that have fled from justice. So that certainly is, you know, our investigative area has always kind of stayed true over the couple hundred years for that. The same with our protective operations. You know, we are about protecting the integrity of the judicial process. And so some will say we're kind of uniquely have a central position in the justice system, but it's really that protection of that justice system and what we take pride in the Constitution and democracy. So our history, when you run into a marshal, always want to talk about the history, you know, because we're 1789 and we're really a part of the first president saying, hey, we have a Constitution. It's supported by laws. And we need people to help enforce that. And so we've kind of stayed true to that, along with handling a lot of national emergencies and disturbances that occur, you know, prior to Homeland Security. And so in that investigative and protective operation really lies what I will say is our fugitive work, a new responsibility that came to us in 2006 on the Adam Walsh Act, where we are really trying, where, you know, the state and local environments in general, both you'll hear from the administrator myself, you know, the federal role and then supporting that state and local to eliminate the criminal element. And so, you know, we are tapped because of that tracking capability to get these non-compliant sex offenders, you know, kind of track them down and help the states get them into compliance and also find those that flee and the nonviolent. We've done incredible work, you know, probably over 55,000 apprehensions as it relates to violent non-compliant sex offenders over that, getting that new responsibility. So that's new to us. And we embrace that and work a lot with state and locals in trying to make sure that we protect the children, you know, of the country. And so, and also in that is the seizure of, you know, any assets that are purchased. That's a lot of joint work.
I was about to say, isn't that what DEA does?
Yeah, you'll say that that's kind of the back half of that investigative work where you'll, you know, Michelle's, you know, when the DEA, if I can use them for an example, out, you know, working an investigation and trying to dismantle that criminal element as it relates to drugs. So I know she'll talk about that, but we're kind of swooping in to kind of seize that asset that those investigators have identified. You know, we've put investigators with them, and those individuals work really hard. And part of that is critical to dismantling that organization, right? That those assets aren't still out there, and that we able to reinvest that in law enforcement and redirect that to victims of crime. So that's a great work that's done across the law enforcement agencies. But of course, we're responsible to seize that and also to kind of sale, you know, you'll hear about the sales from the marshals, and then funnel that back into the Department of Justice. So we all work with that U.S. attorney to get that done. So all of that kind of lies in the investigative side. And then on the judicial protection side and protecting that judicial process lies the protection of the judiciary, the U.S. attorneys. You know, we have a heavy role in protecting those and the threats that they receive every single day.
Which is up dramatically.
It's dramatically up. And, you know, I'll say there's over 2,000 federal judiciary, you know, so responsible for them on site and off site, making sure that we address the threats that they have to face every day and the criminal element that's in the courts. Which has dramatically changed. You know, a lot of street crime is in the federal system that you didn't see 30 years ago. And then also the U.S. attorneys and their assistants, which, you know, is about 5,500. So a big protective responsibility there. And then, of course, the managing and running of the witness protection program and those that are put into the program.
Which there's lots of movies made about.
There's lots of movies made about.
And I always look at that going, I wonder if any of it is true. Just any of what they're doing.
I'm not
going
to confirm or deny or say anything.
And that's our
standard rule.
Right.
So, but I will tell you that 18,000.
But, you know, you must be doing an enormously good job, because when was the last time we ever heard of somebody who went into WITSEC, right? I know, I just sort of like, we're all knocking wood here. I'm not even going to finish the thought, but you know what I'm saying.
I do.
Whatever it is, however it works, it seems to have really worked.
Yeah, I mean, that's what you'll hear us say kind of key from the front end law enforcement and working with that U.S. attorney, and I'm sure the administrator will talk a lot about that also, but both of those are critical to helping dismantle those criminal organizations and those enterprises. So we're situated kind of on the outskirts of those particular pieces of those investigations, you know, but kind of play a critical role in kind of managing that through the systems and it's, you know, witness security. We grow and evolve with that every day since the 70s, and it changes. Just as the climate around us, but 18,000, you know, over 18,000 individuals have been in and out of those programs over the years, and it's been a critical asset to the Department of Justice, mm-hmm. Just like asset forfeiture.
It's amazing how much you do with how the resources you have. It truly is amazing.
Right. And then, of course, we have our Special Operations Group, which has played a critical role since the 70s in civil disturbances. You know, as a member of that group for 10 years, so really kind of an elite paramilitary group that we house that, you know, has responded to wounded knee, has gotten squatters off of federal properties, you know, shots fired, handling the Marilitos as they came into Southern Florida and the processing of over 125,000 individuals, securing such situations as the World Trade Center bombings, the first time in protection details, moving high visibility prisoners and tracking some of the fugitives with our investigative operations. And so they're kind of like a SWAT team paramilitary group. Mm. That kind of gives you a picture of the different elements and responsibilities and units that we have inside the Marshal Service to accomplish that.
You really have your hands full.
It's good.
It's great. People could see her. She's the broadest, biggest smile, truly somebody who really loves her work and doing wonderful things. To me, one of the most interesting things about what the Marshal Service does is the overlap of an executive branch function and mission mm-hmm. into this other branch of government. And when we talk, because Michelle and I talked about this before today's show, but when we talk about like how the world and law enforcement changed post 9/11, you know, information sharing, working together, Marshal Service sort of was doing that. Well, I mean, you were working with another branch of government, and I think working to protect another branch of government. And it's one of the few places in the executive branch where you cross out and over into another branch of government. And I think it's very interesting work. And I always appreciate every time I walk into a federal courthouse.
Well, thank you for that. Yeah, we consider ourselves kind of like the Marine Corps of the law enforcement world. We're a very small unit, but very, you know, there's a lot of people just as proud. But that's why it's a privilege to lead those individuals. Yeah. There's such character and integrity.
Yeah. And Administrator Lenhart, I want to give you the opportunity to tell us about what DEA, I mean, your initials say what you are, but tell people, what are those things that you do, and what are some of the most important things that DEA is doing today?
Well, the Drug Enforcement Administration, you know, our role is to enforce federal drug laws, the Controlled Substances Act, and we're the only single mission agency in the government. We're a small agency, but we're very strong. We've got a very dangerous mission. Mm-hmm. And we do that across the country with 21 field divisions, over 200 offices. And we are the largest law enforcement presence around the globe. Mm-hmm. So we have foreign presence.
Which didn't occur to me until you told me that. I mean, I knew that, but it didn't occur to me until you pointed that out for me yesterday, that Of course, that's right. I knew that. DEA has always been international.
And we have to be, because when you look at the biggest and the baddest that Director Hilton talks about, that we together go after, the biggest and the baddest are not on our soil. They are running their operations. The command and control of those organizations are foreign. So, of course, the Drug Enforcement Administration had to expand into foreign countries. And there we develop partners so that the source for the drugs, we can start at the source and investigate from there. That leads us to investigations domestically, and that's where the cases are charged. So this small but very powerful agency just celebrated its 40th anniversary. We've been around.
You've got a ways to go, I think.
But when you look at what's been accomplished over 40 years, it's absolutely amazing. Our main job, quite frankly, is to identify the major drug trafficking organizations around the world, those that are funding terror, those that are sending drugs and getting drugs on the streets of America. We go after them. We put together with all of our partners, whether it's domestic law enforcement, state, local, federal, tribal, or with our international partners, put together very solid cases that can be brought into U.S. courts. And it's been very successful. We've identified the biggest and the baddest around the world. And right now, if you look at what damage have we done to those organizations, you can't name a Colombian cartel anymore. They've been wiped out because of the great work of the DEA and our partners. When you look at drug trafficking around the world and how it's shifted, for instance, we've stood offices up in Africa. We have a very strong presence in Afghanistan. We are where the source of the drugs are, and we've had great success. Of the biggest and the baddest, what you would normally call the kingpins, DEA and our partners are responsible for the indictments of over 76% of those biggest and the baddest. And we've actually put the cuffs on and put into jail over 50% of them. And a great statistic to look at is how those countries wanting to get rid of those biggest and baddest drug traffickers have actually extradited to the United States over 36%
of them. That's how they get here, extradition.
That's correct. And then we convict them because of the great work of the men and women of the DEA and our state and local and federal partners.
Yeah. I mean, I think everybody knows that. That's the rap on DEA. You know, when DEA shows up or you know they're back there, someone's going down, because they don't usually show up and get it wrong. It usually, you know, that's anecdotally from representing DEA agents or others in federal law enforcement. DEA has an enormously good history in being patient, being thorough, and getting it right. And I've met so many of your agents who really pride themselves on that.
We're very proud of that. And, you know, I have the privilege of leading and have the privilege, having been an agent for almost 33 years, of working with the most dedicated men and women, the most focused and skilled law enforcement officers anywhere. Yeah. And we're recognized around the world for that.
Yeah, no, you have a worldwide reputation. And it's, like I say, when DEA shows up, you really don't want to be around. Same thing for the Marshals Service. You just don't want to be around. Something bad's going down. And I do want, in the next segment of our show, I want to preview for our listeners that since we do have two agency heads from two federal law enforcement agencies, you can't have a conversation today without talking about what's changed post 9/11, after the 9/11 Commission was really critical of the stovepiping that went on in our government. But we do need to take our mid-show break. You're listening to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
GEICO's famous for saving people money on car insurance. And now, if you're a federal employee, you could be saving even more. In fact, you may already qualify for a special federal discount from GEICO. If you're a federal employee, or if you belong to an association like BIG, FEW, FLIOA, Young Government Leaders, and many others, you could be saving hundreds of dollars. Contact GEICO today to get a quote and be sure to request your special federal savings. GEICO got its start back in 1936, specifically to serve federal employees. Today, we're still making it easy for federal employees to save money on car insurance. If you're a federal employee, you may qualify for a special federal employee discount. Or if you belong to an association like Big, Few, Young Government Leaders, and many others, you may also qualify. See how much you could be saving. Contact GEICO today to get a quote and be sure to request your special federal savings.
I'm Deborah Roth, host of Fed Talk and partner at the law firm of Shaw Bransford & Roth. Our firm specializes in helping federal employees with legal issues concerning their jobs or benefits. For two decades, we have been representing federal employees in adverse action cases, employment discrimination complaints, inspector general and internal affairs investigations, security clearance issues, and other federal employment disputes. If you have a legal concern, don't wait. Call Shaw Bransford & Roth at 202-463-8400 or visit our website at shawbransford.com. Welcome back to Fed Talk. I'm Deborah Roth. I'm hosting this morning's show. It's our quarterly federal law enforcement show. And with us in the studio today are really three people who know a lot about federal law enforcement. We have Kathy Sands with us. She's the president of Women in Federal Law Enforcement. Kathy had her own very long, we won't say how many years, career in law enforcement. We're going to speak with Kathy at the last segment of our show about issues facing women in federal law enforcement and what's on WIFL's agenda. We also have with us Michelle Lenhart. She is the administrator of DEA, spent an entire career there. And we have with us our final guest is Stacia Hilton, who's the director of the U.S. Marshals Service, also spent her career from start to finish at the U.S. Marshals Service. Before the break, I told our listeners that the next thing we would be talking about is something that you get the opportunity to talk about with people at cocktail parties and conferences and functions, but you rarely get the opportunity to talk about it with two people who run agencies. And that's this whole issue of post 9/11 information sharing inside the government, in law enforcement, between federal agencies, with state and locals, federal law enforcement agencies and the IC community. And I know things have changed. I knew it when the Boston Marathon bombing occurred. I knew it had changed, and then I watched it go down. And it was, to me, I've said this to the both of you, to me it was most amazing to watch how swiftly and professionally and calmly we turned that around so quickly, so very quickly. But I do want to give each of you an opportunity to talk about post 9/11, how your agencies have shifted in this idea of information sharing. And Director Hilton, why don't we start with you?
Well, I think you would hear from all of us in law enforcement that we're particularly pleased of the shifting and how it occurred so that we could leverage each other's resources and assets, right, and capabilities, because we each bring a different, unique skill set to law enforcement based on what our mission is. So I think, you know, while we've all worked together over the years, and you heard the administrator talk about how they had to work locally to, you know, kind of dismantle these, you know, criminal enterprises. We work locally for state and local support, you know, even chasing fugitives. We had these great bonds, but as far as being able to break down the barriers to share intel quickly, to be able to share information that we had on individuals, to be able to put analytical skills on that, and to leverage that across government is the change. You know, so there's no more territorial stovepiping, because it's like, get the criminal element. We had a new threat, right? We had foreign terrorism on our soil. That was new, right? We suffered through domestic terrorism, right-wing terrorists in the 80s, Oklahoma City bombing, and those type of threats that we faced in the 90s. But Ground 11 changed the way that we looked at the world. And so what does law enforcement do? The same as the military. We pride ourselves to protect and serve. So it's like, everybody drop everything. We got to do everything we can. And I think there was an energy behind that, just mm-hmm. as you saw the general public wanting to get in military, get in law enforcement to protect this country, right? Our patriotism kind of shone through. And so the capabilities were a struggle for us to learn how to operate in each other's systems. But I think we've grown and evolved through that, you know, over the kind of the 10 years to kind of get us there and to be able to do intelligence sharing. And, You know, I always say that you see it at its best because it doesn't really matter about the funding situation. We're all there. During the shutdown, you know, always be proud of the men and women of the Marshal Service because they worked through it.
Because they went to work.
Pay or no pay.
Right.
You know, we're getting shot at, rammed by vehicles, you know, sharing whatever we can to protect in the shootings and the targets of the public officials. And that, you know, there, you know, you can look at those men and women and say, I work with incredible people. But, you know, that's that same momentum that, you know, you start to see. And after 9/11, I think some great advances have been made in the way that we work and support each other, you know, so that our national security agencies, the FBI, and those people have what they need from us to continue to look on that front. And we still stay focused on our mission area also and kind of share that information.
And Administrator Lenhart, you and I talked about this yesterday before the show, and you very politely told me, you know, we've kind of been doing this even before 9/11, which had I thought about it, I would have actually agreed. I think DEA was in the forefront of really not stovepiping. It wasn't really, I mean, I'm sure it had its issues, but the nature of how you do your business internationally and who your bad guys are sort of made you really well suited to get past that issue post 9/11.
You're right. And a couple thoughts on that. When DEA was formed 40 years ago, the big issue was how to share information, how to work together collaboratively with our state and local partners. So over the years, prior to 9/11, we had great successes with our state and local partners standing up task forces so that there was not a difference. You didn't have to worry if someone worked for DEA or someone worked for a certain police department. If you were on that task force, you were all equal. You were sharing information. And that grew over the years. And then we realized we needed to go, you know, share intelligence, just not in a particular city or region. We needed to figure out how to share that across the whole country and with other federal agencies. And so pieces were built along the way, like our Special Operations Division that today has every federal agency that's involved in drug enforcement and representatives from many foreign governments as well, all under one roof, all sharing information and finding ways that we can all target, use our intelligence to target the biggest and the baddest, no matter where they are. And like I said, it usually starts with those organizations that the command and control is overseas. So when 9/11 happened, we already had the basics down.
Right.
And a lot of even the Department of Defense, the intel community, a lot of the federal government turned to DEA and said, how did you do that on the drug issue? How did you get everybody on one sheet of music? How did you do this priority targeting? And so we were able to share what we had done for quite some time, and that helped the whole government look at a way, the best way to form platforms. You know, we have something in law enforcement called deconfliction that we started before 9/11. Mm-hmm. The importance of putting out there who your targets are and who you're looking at so that if FBI in Boston is looking at the same organization, you knew about it immediately and not 3 years later after you all went in to make the arrest and found out, you know, you all had information on the same targets. So those pieces were used to really, in a post 9/11 world, figure out how to best share, how to best deconflict, so that you had synergy and you were using the whole of government to go after the biggest and the baddest.
It's really about connecting what already existed in so many ways that I don't think the public sometimes understands, right? Because they'll hear in the news, why aren't you talking? We're on the ground saying everybody's talking. That's how we're getting them so fast.
Right.
You know, it's amazing how fast. But I don't think people actually realize how fast the photos go up and how fast we have them based on. And all of that is because really that, what I'm going to call that infrastructure piece. But I think that
put in place.
As Michelle's saying, as everybody started saying, okay, we have this. What do you have? And how are we going to connect better so we have it real time?
Mm-hmm. And there's for DEA, there was another piece. We were not in the intelligence community on 9/11, but we were so worried that because we have these great human sources all around the world, we were so worried that we would have a piece of information that would be important to the FBI, mm-hmm. to the CIA, to the agencies looking at these terrorist networks, that we really pushed to become a part of the intel community so that we could open up and share the intelligence information we have, the intelligence products, and the human source information mm-hmm. that is have become critical mm-hmm. in this fight against terrorism.
Right. And that's because if the piece that maybe our listeners aren't getting is that some, I can't quantify it, you probably know, I don't, some terrorist organizations are financed by illegal drug trade. And you already were in those countries pre-9/11. DEA was in those countries stationed there working against drug trafficking. But when you realize, sort of, Director Hill, when you were talking about it, you take away their assets. If you take away a criminal enterprise or a terrorist organization's assets, drugs for money, it's hard to really do business if That's you don't correct. Have your assets anymore.
That's and correct. Right after September 11th, the DEA, we took the initiative to look at all of the terrorist organizations that were designated by the State Department as terrorist organizations. We ran each and every one of them to see if we had ties to the drug organizations that we were targeting around the world. And it was just about 40% of them were connected to our drug organizations. And now, as we see what happened with Al-Qaeda and other terrorist organizations, they are able to fund their terrorist activities because they've gotten involved in drug trafficking. So the whole narco-terrorism piece post 9/11 has been a very, very important piece of what DEA does every day around the world.
And for people who are very interested in it, your website does an excellent job educating people about the narco-terrorism piece. Like I say, I always think of myself as being pretty well educated and knowledgeable. I work in this town. I represent your agents who have issues or trouble with their employment. I love learning what they do. And then all of a sudden I get that epiphany. How come I didn't realize, of course, narco-terrorism would be, you know, narco-drug trafficking would fund terrorist organizations. It's always this epiphany. And then I go on the website and I look and see what they're doing. And it is dangerous stuff they're doing out there in other parts of the world. And we certainly want to have more conversation with the two of you about post 9/11 federal law enforcement information sharing. We're short on time. We do have to take the final commercial break on our show. You're listening to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Today, my journey to help save people money on car insurance brought me to our nation's capital. I was taking a stroll around a mall when I met a very nice gentleman from Ohio who asked me a question. What kind of word is Geico anyway? An excellent question, I replied. I told him that Geico isn't a word, it's an acronym, and it stands for Government Employees Insurance Company. I explained how Geico actually got its start 75 years ago to help federal employees save money on car insurance. Interesting, the man replied. But today, Geico saves lots of people money on car insurance, including me. Have you ever thought about changing the name? I said. It's a thought. But Gecko sounds like Geico. If we change the name, I might be out of a job. We strolled a bit more, stopped for some tea, and we both agreed. It's probably best to keep the name just like it is. Geico.
To get a free rate quote, go to geico.com. Then buy online or over the phone. If you're a federal employee or belong to an association like Big, Few, Young Government Leaders, and others, you may qualify for a special discount. Contact Geico today to request your special federal savings.
Welcome back to Fed Talk. I'm Deborah Roth. I'm hosting this morning's show. If you just tuned in, you've missed really a great 47 minutes of information from two of the top people in federal law enforcement today. We have with us in the studio Stacia Hilton. She's the director of the U.S. Marshals Service. We also have Michelle Lenhart. She's the administrator of DEA. And we have with us women in federal law enforcement. Representing them today is Kathy Sands, the president of WIFL. She's held many positions in WIFL, had really quite an impressive career of her own in law enforcement. And I wanted to spend the last few minutes of the show talking with WIFL about, you know, frankly, what do these two women represent for an organization like Women in Federal Law Enforcement?
Oh, they're incredible role models. Some of our research is showing that without women at the top positions, in these agencies that younger women don't see the possibility. Everything becomes impossible for them. And when you have a strong role model, suddenly the world opens up for them. The one thing your listeners didn't or haven't heard is the incredible backstories of these two women on how they got where they were. And they give great credit to mentors and their networks and sponsors and being pushed and prodded along the way sometimes to get out of their comfort zones. And I think you find that in for many women who are in the higher ranking positions. I was tapped several times and said, I got a job for you to do and you're going to do it. You're going to be happy doing it. And that was one of my mentors. So these women help bring a sense of community mm-hmm. to women in federal law enforcement, because we still are a small minority of the group. And
you were telling me before the show, it's 18,000 police chiefs nationwide?
I believe it's 18,000 police departments and sheriff's departments in that, and that there's less than 300 women chiefs. The percentages, the averages are in the state and local side and on the federal side are kind of together. There are still police departments with no women. And then there are departments and agencies with very high percentages of women. But when you take the averages, we come out to being that 15-16%. You don't start to get real culture change in an organization until you're up in the 20s, maybe even 30s, depending on the organization. And oddly, the military is about the same percentage rate, too. We all tend to hang around that area. WIFL provides that one of the opportunities, because we are a minority, and in some places you may be the only woman in an office, even though you have a decent percentage in your agency, but because the federal government is so spread out, there may be one.
Mm-hmm.
And so there is nobody to talk to. You have to literally go outside your agency to find somebody to ask a simple question of, because we all suffer from the same problem. We don't want anybody to really know we don't know. And so you want to find a friendly voice, a friendly shoulder to say, hey, how do you do this? And then they tell you, and then you go back to work. And so our leadership training and our networking, with the help of the director and the administrator and the director of the Secret Service and all the other heads of agencies who are work very hard to increase their diversity, we come together and we try to give women an opportunity to expand their capabilities, to become more competitive.
And, of course, to network.
Yes.
You know, it's I've been to, as you know, of course, I've been to the last handful of your conferences, and but for this past year with the sequestration, you know, you're getting 700 female federal law enforcement agents. And for me, when I've been in the room and had the opportunity to be around them or to speak to them, to me, what was most interesting is they're just agents. That's how they think of themselves. And they come together in a community to, you know, to just have a common bond. But when you talk to each of them individually, they really just think of themselves as agents, not women going to work, but agents. And it's just a very interesting experience to be at the conference. And your content of the conference is always incredible. And for women who are listening, who want to go to, who are thinking about attending the conference, go on their website, look at the kind of content they have in the conference. I think the organization, at a minimum, just offers women who are out there in law enforcement knowing, you know, you can do this. You can do this, which is what I think these two women also represent. You can do it. Administrator Lenhart's role model was Nancy Drew. And isn't it hysterical that you're now people's role model?
Well, let me say, we have a lot of role models at DEA, and one of the role models for me at when I became a supervisor and since, and also as a role model for men and women in mm-hmm. DEA, is Special Agent Meredith Thompson, an agent who was fairly young, was doing very dangerous work in Peru, going after and taking down cocaine labs in the jungle. She died in a plane crash along with four other agents. So we don't have to look very far at DEA to find heroes, to find role models, and people that just make us work harder. One of those.
Whether they're men or women.
Whether they're men or women. Correct. One of those on a memorial wall is Meredith Thompson. Yeah. So I think more people in my agency think of her as a role model before they would think of the administrator or any of the other supervisors and executive staff within DEA. But WIFL has given us as leaders a way to give back, a way to give those words of advice or encouragement so that women that aren't sure that they even want to move on into supervisory roles, see that we felt the same way. If you told me, 30 years ago that I would have been a supervisor within DEA, I would have said, no, I'm not. I just want to work cases. I want to go undercover. I want to lock up the bad guy.
Yeah.
Not
great.
Manage.
I think we all
Who wants
did.
To sit in the
we
office?
We still want to.
Yeah,
I know that the that. Two of you still want to, because when you were seven, you wanted to. How would the desire to do that go away? To me, I've had this conversation with each of you separately. For me, that's what gets you to the top. It's the desire to do the work. It's doing good work and just forging ahead without really thinking about, can I do this because of my gender? I think you get tripped up in that, And you were, when I hear your stories, you were like single-minded. It's like, I really want to do that work.
I don't think we ever thought about it. Even when we get asked that question, we're on a lot of panels together and we always kind of shake our head. But the one common thing that you would learn from a lot of the women that are on the top is I never paid it. I was just focused on my job. We've learned to embrace the conversations and thank WIFL and Kathy, thank you for your words earlier, because we realize that there are other people that need that. And that's what will help, but I think, it's true. We're just kind of doing our jobs. We love to do our jobs. It's what the administrator said. I mean, we lose men and women on this job every single day that have given up their life for their country. And we have experienced, even through my 10 years leadership, unbelievable loss.
Yeah.
And so I thank all those federal military that are listening and law enforcement, state and local, that put their life on the line every single day to go through that door. That's how we pick up 123,000 fugitives every year, and we get them off the street to protect our people. But we have lost incredible people, and they are our heroes, and we continue that fight for that reason every single day and that dedication. I think that's who we look for. We don't have to have them above us. We can have them beside us. We can have them working for us.
And we don't look, what gender are they?
Yeah, right. It
doesn't matter.
They're just good agents.
Right, and I would say that, too, in my own personal experience, 24 years at the same law firm where my mentor was a man, to me, when I looked back upon it, the most astonishing thing is the whole conversation was always gender neutral. But I think WIFL serves at a very important place.
That's correct.
Where, we're heading into the last 30 seconds of our show. I think it serves a very important place for women who do have doubt, that there's an organization where they can go to, meet with other women, talk to the women, talk to two women that, that don't even realize they're role models. And I encourage everybody, Kathy, to go to your website. It's WIFL.org. And, of course, everybody knows DEA.org. DEA.gov.
USMarshals.gov.
Thank you for all of you for being on our show.
Thank you, Debra.
Thank you.